For joining us today for part two, excuse me, in our Haggadah class. So last week was more of an overview of the Haggadah in general, and as I mentioned last week, this week we're going to look primarily at Magid, and Magid begins with Halach Ma'anya. So if you find the page, it's after you should see Kadesh, Urchatz, Karpas, Yachatz, and then we get into Magid. Okay, Yachatz is when we break the matzah. Now, last week I happened to mention, as I just wanted to share with you, I found the actual source where I originally saw this. It was the one of the Gera Rebbes who would sometimes put strawberries or pineapples or even bananas for karpas. And the whole point was, again, as I mentioned last week, to get people to ask questions. Another source which is mentioned in that same place talked about using cucumbers. Okay, so again, it doesn't really matter what is used. The main thing is that since our custom is to have a borei pri ha'adama item, so anything that falls into the category of the bracha borei pri ha'adama is something which can certainly be utilized. It's all minhagim, customs, and we have to just remember that there's a difference between a minhag and a halacha. Yeah, halacha is a law. The law is something which we want to do our best to follow. A minhag, a custom is, what's your minhag? Okay, last week I did a poll of the audience and found that different people have different customs when it came to which vegetable was used for karpas. So those are just ideas, and I'm not going to repeat what was otherwise said last week. Okay, so Magid is the section of the Haggadah in which we fulfill one of our main mitzvahs of the evening. The main mitzvahs that we have in the evening of the Seder are Torah-level mitzvahs, which are given to us. Torah-level means that it's written in the Torah. And rabbinic-level mitzvahs, which are discussed in later sources. That means they're not mentioned in the Torah, or they might be mentioned in the Torah, but owing to different realities of the Jewish experience now, they're not obligatory. Okay, so for example, the two main mitzvos that are in the Torah that we can fulfill now are the mitzvah of eating matzah and the mitzvah of telling over the story of the Exodus from Egypt. There are other Torah mitzvos which we can't do at the Seder. We can't eat a Korban Pesach because we don't bring a Korban Pesach because we don't have a Beis HaMikdash. There's no temple in Jerusalem where we can slaughter the lamb and therefore eat it. But we do eat it, in a sense. Anybody remember how we eat the Korban Pesach? Today, we have something in place of the Korban Pesach. Okay, that's the Afi Kalman is in place of it. And that's one of the reasons why the last thing that we eat at the Seder is the Afi Kalman, because when the Korban Pesach was at the Seder, that was the last thing. Now, what is more exciting? To have some roast lamb, that's the last thing you ate before you go to sleep, or a piece of matzah? Okay, and that's why I hope for the Beis HaMikdash to be rebuilt. Okay, another one is maror, because maror, the whole idea of eating maror was to eat it with the Korban Pesach. So we're not eating it in the proper way. So when we fulfill maror, we're doing it on a rabbinic level. Okay, it's a commemoration. Another rabbinic mitzvah is to have the four cups of wine. Nowhere in the Torah does it say that when you're eating your Korban Pesach and your matzah, that you have to have four cups of wine. Okay, that's a rabbinic discussion, and it starts in the Mishnah, and it's something which we're familiar with. By the time we get to Halach Ma'anya, by the time we get to Magid, so we've already had our first cup of wine, and we have not yet filled the second cup. Now, one thing which I didn't mention, although those who were here on Shabbos heard Rabbi Liebtag, he mentioned it once or twice in his various presentations. One of the themes which is talked about in the Mishnah, when it describes how to do the evening of the Seder, is what's called Maschil Begnus U'Mesayim B'Shevach, which means that you want to begin with denigrating information when it comes to telling over the story of the Exodus, and you want to conclude with Shevach, which is praise. Now, there are two ways which we can define the word shevach. One is praiseworthy stuff about us, and another one is praise of The Almighty. Okay, the praise of God. So, as we saw last week, we saw different ways. In other words, one of the ways that I presented what's given to us in Magid are different levels of how to tell over the story. So one way of telling over this concept of gunus, negative, degrading information about us, is avadim hayinu l'paro b'mitzrayim. Okay, that we were slaves in Egypt, slaves to Paro in Egypt. That's pretty rotten. I mean, who wants to remember that we were slaves? Okay, nowadays, you know, it's interesting, and I don't want to get too political, but you know, there is a community in America whose some of their ancestors were once upon a time slaves, right? There's no denying the history of the United States of America and slavery. And there are some people who, until this day, call for reparations. We want reparations. Okay, can you prove that your ancestors were slaves? Can you prove that everybody else's ancestors were slave owners? Okay, 5% of the people in the country, in the South rather, were slave owners. Most people weren't even slave owners. So who owes who? Okay, but if you want to live as a slave, you want to continue to live as a slave, then what do you keep doing? You say, give me, give me, give me. I want reparations. And that was a big debate in the founding of Israel, by the way, between Ben-Gurion, for example, and Menachem Begin. Ben-Gurion said, Germany's going to pay. Whatever they pay, we'll take it. Menachem Begin said, we don't want their money. Okay, and it's a debate, right? How much do you want to hold on to that ancient, that old? So Avadim HaYinu L'Paro is degrading. It's gnus. That's something which you don't necessarily want to remember, but of course that's part of the story. You have to begin that way. Misayim B'Shevach, God took us out of Egypt. Amazing. Another way is mitchila of the avodah zarah. Another phrase which we're going to get to soon is that originally our ancestors were idolaters, and we when we think about that, the pasuk actually says, it's a verse in the book of Yehoshua where he says that Terach Avi Abraham, Terach Abraham's father was an idolater, and Abraham broke from the mold and he started something else, and eventually they came down to Egypt. Okay, that's the gnus. It's negative. And then the Shevach is the same thing, right? God took us out of Egypt, amazing. And it just depends on the level and the degree. When it comes to Halach Ma'anya, so what we're essentially doing is we're setting the stage. We hold up the matzah, we say Halach Ma'anya, this is the bread of Anya. Now, Anya is an interesting word. Okay, if forget about whatever translation they have here. Don't look there. Okay, if I would pull the word, the room, and say, what does the word ayin nun yud mean? Okay, what does that mean?
Poor.
Okay, poor. But Anya is Aramaic. So which ayin nun yud is it really following? Okay, because we have another concept, which is inui. What's inui? Ayin nun yud. Same letters. What's inui? Suffering. Yom Kippur, right? Inui. There's another word, right? La'anot. To answer, to talk. Halach Ma'anya has different meanings. So when we are holding up the matzah, we could say it's the bread of poor people. We could say it's the bread of suffering, affliction. That's the way some of the Haggadahs translate it. We could say it's the bread to talk over. When you have the matzah, you have to talk. Now, which interpretation is correct? I don't know. It's discussed amongst authorities. Which interpretation speaks to you? Which interpretation speaks to me? Okay, so that's for each person to decide, but that's it. I think that with the Halach Ma'anya, or certainly the different possibilities, opens the door to discussion. And if you recall from last week, the goal of the Seder event is to have conversations. That's what we're trying to achieve. So in an ideal world, there are generations there. In a different kind of ideal, you don't have generations. I just had a fellow here who some of you may have seen when you walked in, who was telling me that he runs a singles Seder event where he specifically does not have children there because he wants people, and he doesn't have couples. He wants people to all be in the same kind of situation so that they're all comfortable, because sometimes it's uncomfortable. This past Shabbos, we had the infertility awareness Shabbos, and I don't know if any of you got the chance to read some of the essays that were written in that little packet. We didn't have a lot, but it was sent out in the email before Shabbos. You have to read these essays. It's those of us who have children and grandchildren don't necessarily see so easily the pain that people who don't have children or grandchildren, I'm not talking about present, I'm talking about in general, who don't have at all, that what they experience at the Pesach Seder. Because what's the whole thing about? Ah, Manishtana, the youngest person asks. Ah, let the youngest kid ask. Connect Arba Abanim, there are four sons, four children, however you want to define it. We made jokes about it last year from the artwork, when it's a boy or a girl, whatever, but it doesn't matter, right? It's the child that we're talking about. So if somebody doesn't have that, it could be a tremendous source of pain. One of the essays in that pamphlet is written by a couple that said, why we're eating our Seder alone? Hey, we can't handle it. It's just too painful because they're suffering infertility for years and years and years and being around a Seder with, and it's their family, they love them, but it's just too much. So that's something which is another Anya, Halachma Anya. This is the bread of what? Of suffering, affliction, poor, or something which we need to have a conversation about. And we're inviting people here and saying, look, this is where we are, this is where we want to be. The next year in Jerusalem. And I think that's just a beautiful image that we carry with us when it comes to any Seder, that who are we? We're people who are always looking to the future. Because what is Pesach about? Pesach is about the past. Where are we going? We're going all the way back, as far back as the Jewish people could imagine ourselves. If we had to ask the question, when did the Jewish people begin? So we could have different answers. We could say that we begin, as a nation, we begin at Sinai. That's the latest point that we could say that the Jewish people begin. We could say the Jewish people begin at the Exodus. We could say the Jewish people begin when Yaakov actually has 12 sons, right? And you have the tribes that you can identify. You could say the Jewish people begin with Abraham. We could say the Jewish people really begin when Abraham and Sarah have a child, and when Yitzchak is born. Okay, these are different possibilities. So when we go back, we mention all this stuff in one form or another, and I'm going to show you how as we get through the Seder, through Magid, how we do that. But where are we going with all this? And the answer is that we are looking to a future. Okay, and thank God there are people who, every year, when they say L'shana Bar Ba'ar Di Israel, next year in the land of Israel, they're already in Israel. But what are we looking for? There is one thing that's missing. There's one thing that's missing. Why do we say L'shana Bar Ba'ar Di Israel? One possibility is because we have another mitzvah, which we don't really talk about on the night of the Seder, but we're going to read it in the Torah reading on Pesach, and that is, we have a mitzvah of Aliyah L'Regel, which means going up to Jerusalem for the holiday and to be in the land of Israel. So it's nice to do it today. People talk about it. Yeah, I go all the holidays in Israel. I do Aliyah L'Regel. Very nice. Where are you going? I'm going to Haifa. Very nice. But that's not what Aliyah L'Regel is. Going up to the land of Israel for the holiday means going to Jerusalem. It means going to the temple. It means making the trek. And we know this just simply because of the davening that we say, for example, on Sukkot, at the end of Sukkot and at the beginning of Pesach. The ones related to rain and the ones related to dew. The one at the end of Sukkot, we pray for rain, and we don't really start the same bracha. The same kalamata. We don't start saying that. In Israel, they start saying it 2 weeks after Sukkot. Why? Because they want the people who come to Jerusalem to be able to walk home without getting rained on. So even though we have Tefillah Geshem, we're basically saying, we're praying for rain, but like hold off for 2 weeks, okay? Let people get all the way. And then Pesach people come, and immediately we say, no, we're praying for rain. No, we're praying for rain, because we want people to be able to just enjoy the holiday without that kind of disturbance. Okay, so again, L'shana Bar Ba'ar Yisrael, even for the people in Israel, means we're looking for a different kind of just being in the land. And as long as there's a building with a kippah on top of it in the center of Jerusalem, which politics today will not allow for a change. That's why we're looking for something much bigger and grander to happen. But until that temple is built, we're going to all continue to say, L'shana Bar Ba'ar Yisrael. Okay, next is the Manishtana. I spoke about that last week, making the point that Manishtana is really one question. It's more rhetorical. In what way is this night different? And it's setting the stage, again, for conversations. These are observations. Observations that a child or anybody around the table can make. It's nice that some people have a custom to say it in as many languages as possible. The fact of the matter is that even if people say it in any languages that they know, most people around the table will probably understand one or two languages. So it just needs to be understood what we're doing here, and the observations thereof are in the Manishtana. Okay, so I'm not going to go into that more. So I mentioned Avadim Ayinu. I'm gonna skip that for now. I want to go to, and I'm gonna skip some of the things, some of these things I mentioned last week, just in terms of understanding the story and the setting of the stage and the rabbis. I want to get to immediately after Ben Zoma, the teaching of Ben Zoma, which is shared by Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah. Okay, so in your Agada, it should say in big words, Baruch Hamakom, Baruch Hu, Baruch Shenasan Torah L'Am Yisrael, Baruch Hu. Okay, everybody with me? Baruch Hamakom, Baruch Hu?
Yes.
Can you?
Okay.
It might have the four sons on the page, and it should be at the top of the page. Okay? Yeah, Baruch Hamakom. Okay? Sorry, in my Agada, it's in really big letters. Okay. All right. Now, first of all, I have to make an acknowledgement. My memories of my own Siddharim growing up, my father is a rabbi of a shul, as many of you know, and so we always had our Siddharim at home. And because my father is an only child, his parents would join us. And so I have many wonderful memories of my grandparents at the Seder. My grandfather used to sometimes ask me, not at the Seder, he had other lines and comments at the Seder, but he would ask me, what was the name of the fellow who gave the Torah to the Jewish people? And I said to him, Moshe. And he said, no, his name was Baruch. Baruch Shenasan Torah Le'amo Yisrael. I said, okay. Anyway, that's not what the verse means. Okay, Baruch means blessed is the one who gave the Torah to the Jewish people, but of course Baruch is used as a name. Okay, anyway, you could tell that joke or not. You don't have to tell the joke. What I wanted to focus on was the word Hamakom. Hamakom. Okay, and the word Makom was actually the topic of the drasha, the Shabbat Shuva drasha this year. I focused on the phrase Baruch Hashem. Baruch Kavod Hashem Mimakomo, right? The idea that we bless God from His place, and what does His place mean? And that there are different places which are described in the Torah, for example, that, like for example, when Abraham is going to the top of the mountain with Yitzchak, the pasuk says "Vayaras Hamakom Merachok," that he saw Hamakom. Hamakom could be referring to the actual spot, but it could also be referring to God. And so when we talk about Baruch Hamakom, Baruch Hu, of course we're talking about God. Blesses Hamakom, right? God in the ultimate place. But we also have to recognize that we're part of a tremendous story of Jewish history. That example of Abraham is just one example. Yaakov, when he's traveling to Lavan for the first time, which is also part of what takes place here. The Torah tells us, Vayifga Bamakom, that Yaakov had an encounter Bamakom. What does that mean? In that spot, did he encounter God? We know he had the dream with the ladder and the angels, but there's this concept of Makom which is sown through the narrative of the Torah. And we have to remember that when we say Baruch HaMakom, yes, we're probably talking about God, but we can't ignore what Hamakom represents. And Hamakom represents the different encounters that Abraham, Yitzchak, Yaakov, etc. had with this concept of Makom. And it's a deeper connection with God. Remember that the story that we are telling over is, yes, it's a story of Exodus. Yes, it's a story of getting out of Egypt and going may Abdus L'Cherus from slavery to freedom. But there's another extremely important theme, which I touched briefly on last week, in noting that Moshe's name appears in the Haggadah one time, and it's only as an aside. In other words, it's just in passing. It's in the Pasuk of Vayaminu Bashem Uve Moshe Avdo, the pasuk which immediately precedes the Az Yashir, the song of the sea that the people sang after the splitting of the sea. And why is it that Moshe doesn't appear? I mean, if you have to think about the story, you're going to tell over the story. I promise that even any conversation that's going to happen outside of the format of the Haggadah, Moshe's name is going to come up. It has to. We're not ignoring Moshe. But the Haggadah's focus is not on Moshe. The Haggadah's focus is on God. Okay, and I'm going to prove it to you from another really incredible insight that I found from Rabbi Joseph Yosef Dov Soloveitchik, A.K.A. in Yeshiva University circles, the Rav Rabbi Soloveitchik, about the very end of Maggid. So just bear with me for a second as we skip to the end of Maggid. Okay. Now, it should be the second to last page. So if anybody finds it in the public Sagada, please announce the page. It should be the second to last page before the end of Maggid. So before, if you find Rachza, then you obviously have gone too far. And it should be where it says Rabban Gamliel. Anybody find it? Yes. What page? 25. Page 25? Okay. Well, it depends on the version. Okay, in most of them it's 25. Okay. So take a look there. There it says, Rabban Gamliel haya omer. Okay, Rabban Gamliel says, Kol shelo amar shlosha dvarim elu b'pesach, lo yatza yideicha vaso, that anybody who did not say the following three things on Pesach has not fulfilled his obligation. Ve'elu hein Pesach matzah mar. The three things you have to mention at the Seder are Pesach, matzah, and mar. Okay, what Rabban Gamliel goes ahead and does, or maybe the Haggadah does, I don't know if this is a quote from Rabban Gamliel, but it's the Haggadah explains why Pesach? Why matzah? Why maror? Okay, now, we can ask a very simple question. I mentioned before, quoting the Mishnah, that when you tell over the story, you have to do things in a format which follows maschil b'gnus. You start with something which is denigrating or a little embarrassing, masayim b'shevach, and you finish with something which is more positive and uplifting. Okay. Now, if Rabban Gamliel says that this is what you need to do, basically what Rabban Gamliel is saying is, everything you've done up until now is very nice. You didn't need to do it. I mean, not that you didn't need to do it, but if you didn't do it, as long as you say this code, you're good. You've fulfilled your obligation. That's what he says. Kol shelo amar, or if you haven't said these three things, you haven't fulfilled your obligation. Which means that what's the most important thing, according to Rabbi Gamliel? These three things. You gotta say these three things. Okay, and then the Haggadah explains what the Pesach and what the Matzah and what the Maror is all about. But Rabbi Soloveitchik asks a question. He says, look, if it's Pesach, Matzah, Marv, those are the three things, so why don't we do it in a way that actually follows the order of that instruction, that it should be something which starts off in the negative and then continues into the positive and the praise. So let's imagine, if that is actually something which is important, which should come first? Okay, I mean, it's a straw man argument. You're going to see why in a second, but it's an interesting question. Which should come first? Correct. Maror, right? Maror represents bitterness, slavery. Which should come next? Okay, so there we could start having an interesting discussion. Matzah represents cherus, represents freedom. Okay, remember, because when are they taking matzah? Now, they ate matzah in Egypt, but one of the images of matzah that we have is they're carrying it on the back on the way out, right? That's freedom. So there's a lot of Torah, I've also spoken about that in the past, in the Shabbos Haggadah stuff, about how matzah represents freedom versus chametz, and what's the difference between those two. Okay, I'm not going to get into that now. And what's Pesach? Pesach is the night in Egypt, right? What does Pesach mean? Okay, we translate it usually to mean the passing over. That's where the English name of the holiday comes from, passing over. Passover is what happened in Egypt. So we can say that Pesach is really the bridge between the Maror and the Matzah. And if you have to put them in an order, then we could certainly make the argument that Matzah goes, that maybe Matzah is in Egypt as well. So then it's Maror first and then, Matzah and Pesach together. But if we're going to separate them, then I think that we can see how the argument that Matzah would be last would make sense. Okay, but what does it say instead? Pesach, matzah, and maror. So Rabbi Soloveitchik's answer to that question about why the order is not doesn't follow that argument is that the Haggadah, and it's actually what the word Haggadah means. Haggadah is, it's a book of studies. In other words, to tell over. But telling over doesn't mean telling over stories. It's not a storybook. He says it's a book of studies in Yetzias Mitzrayim. When you look at Maggid, this section that we're studying now, you see that Maggid is not, it's not a story. It's not like a little
short stories. It's not a chapter book. It's studying the Exodus. Okay, as we're going to see when we go back. But Rabbi Soloveitchik's point is that the Haggadah, the goal of the Haggadah, is that it's about the Talmud Torah, the Torah study of the story of the Exodus. There are references to halacha, but this is a conceptual sequence of mitzvos. So, for example, he says that Pesach and Matzah, the reason why they come first is because we're talking about the mitzvos of the evening. Okay, so which come first? Once you're talking about Torah study and therefore mitzvos, because that's Torah and mitzvos come together, which comes first? Our Torah obligations for the evening. And as I mentioned at the very beginning today, what are our Torah obligations of the night of the Seder? So now we only have two, telling the story and matzah. But in an ideal sense, based on Mikdash time, what's another key mitzvah of the evening? The Karban Pesach. And nowadays, because the Afikoman takes the place of the Karban Pesach, so Pesach and Matzah, Rabbi Soloveitchik says, those come first, because those are the Torah-level mitzvos, what we would call in yeshivish terminology, the mitzvos d'oraisa, Torah-level mitzvos. And what's maror? Rabbinic level. Right, it's only a commemoration. We do it because the rabbis told us, but not because, right, we're not eating it with the actual Karban Pesach, because we don't have a Karban Pesach. And so we eat it separately. The Afikoman, yes, it represents the Karban Pesach, but it is not the Karban Pesach, and so therefore, Pesach and Matzah are just combined together in terms of saying them, simply because that is the Torah-level obligation that we have for this evening. Okay, you can go back to where we were before, and we're up to the four sons. The four sons.
What does
Makom
mean?
Makom means place, but sometimes it's actually defined as being God. Okay. Now, by the way, before I get into the four sons, I wanted to mention one other thing about beginning with denigrating facts or information and concluding with praise. There is a distinction. There is a debate between Rav and Shmuel. These are two rabbis of the Talmud, in which they talk about, they have different versions of the Haggadah. Rav's version of the Haggadah, or Rav's version of how it is that you start with denigrating information and conclude with praiseworthy information, is that you start with the denigrating information is that when we were people who have no mitzvos. So, what's the people with no mitzvos? Well, you can define it as either slavery, or you could define it as people who are idolaters. Okay, but essentially people who are looking at a very different perspective in terms of what does it mean to have God in your life. And the praise is a nation with mitzvos. How are we a nation with mitzvos? We're a nation with mitzvos when we get to Sinai. So that's Rav's view. Shmuel's view is a little different. And he basically goes from the concept of the denigrating is being slaves, and the praise is being redeemed. Just physically looking at who the people are. Are they enslaved or are they no longer enslaved? And so we have both of those in the Haggadah. Our Haggadah is a combination. Okay, and that is just something which you should just, you know, bear in mind in the background. Not that I'm going to get back to that specific point, but just to understand that there are different levels as well of looking at this concept of beginning with denigrating or negative information and concluding with something which is praiseworthy. Okay, now, we get up to the four sons. And the four sons in the Haggadah, it's a fascinating study. I could talk about this for an hour, and I'm not going to now. But when the Haggadah depicts for us the four sons, the Haggadah depicts for us four sons based on the fact that there are four verses in the Torah which describe a conversation that will take place between parent and child. Okay, three of them are really a dialogue where the child asks a question, and the questions which are asked are the questions which the Haggadah tells us, and the reason for the fourth child being what's called the Eino Yodei Lishol, the one who does not know how to ask, is because the Torah has a phrase, V'higata Levincha Bayom Ulemor, which means that you will tell your children on that, or unto your son, on that day. But there's no prompt. Okay, there is no, where the child, the Torah does not say there, the child will ask you, the Torah just says, something's going to happen, and then you'll tell your child that I'm doing this because of.
Okay, and so that's where the Haggadah comes with this idea. Now, the Torah does not depict these children as having ulterior motives. It just defines children as asking a question of the parent. That's it. The Haggadah does it a little differently because the Haggadah is a little more recognition. It recognizes that people study in different ways. Okay, and that's something which I also mentioned last week, straight from the Mishnah, the Pidarko Shel Ben Aviv Melamdo. That's part of the reason for why sometimes the parent has to feed the child the questions or the observations to ask. That's what the way the Mishnah describes. The Manishtana is, Kana Ben Shoel, now the child asks, and Ve'im Das Leben, if the child doesn't have an understanding, then Aviv Melamdo, the parent is supposed to teach, say, hey kid, take a look at the table. Notice anything different? Oh yeah, what's that? I usually see challah over there. Matzah. Ooh, why is that? That's how you teach a child. Now, if the child is more understanding and says, I know everything that's on the table here, then there's another way to engage a child. Oh, do you really know? Do you know what this book is? Oh, yes, I knew. I studied the whole thing in school. Okay, well, do you know what this little thing... I mean, it's just a question of trying to figure out what does the kid not know? And then have a conversation. And as I've been mentioning all along, it's not just about children. It's about anybody who's at the table. But the Torah does not depict these people, these kids, as being any different. Haggadah does, because Haggadah says, look, we're sitting around the table now. This one's angry, this one doesn't want to be here, this one has a problem, this one is, they're all, you know, some people are happy to be here, some people not happy to be here. How do we get them all around the same table to have this conversation? And the answer is, first we have to recognize why each one is here. What's bringing them to the table? And so the Haggadah describes different types of people. Different types of people. Now, yes?
Just out of curiosity, when was the Haggadah compiled?
I don't know. I mentioned that was part of the introduction last week. That it has elements. I mean, look, obviously you have the story of the five rabbis in Bnei Brak, so that's post-destruction of the Beis HaMikdash. Okay? Rabbi Gamliel, you know, spans that time period as well. Of being in that time period. So when you hear those kinds of things in the Haggadah, you know, then you get one sense. But Dayenu, for example, only goes until getting into the land of Israel. I don't know when it was composed, but it's only talking about one aspect of history. Even though it tells us about the five rabbis of Bnei Brak, it doesn't give us the history up until that, because that's not the point of the Haggadah. I don't know when it was compiled. I can tell you that the Haggadah is probably... I never did an actual survey, but I'm pretty sure that the Haggadah and Megillas Esther are the two singular books that have the most written about them, okay, or the most commentary on them. I mean, every year new Haggadahs come out, not even with commentary, or not even from, you know, I'll say a frum source. Okay, everybody comes up with a new Haggadah. And unfortunately, a lot of them are tainted with political ideas now. You could twist anything the way you want it. But I don't know the exact answer when it was put together. Okay? I mean, the idea that there's an Afikoman clearly indicates that it was put together after the destruction of the Beis HaMikdash. Yeah.
Yeah.
I'm going to get back to that point.
You'll get back to that.
Yeah, I mean, one of them is in Devarim 6. Devarim, I'll tell you the exact sources. Devarim 6:20. The next one is Shmos 12:26. Shmos 13:14. And the last one is Shmos 13:8. Shmos 13:8. Okay. Now the ant. What the Haggadah does is it takes the answers which are given in those questions and mixes them around a little bit. So if you're... Shmos 13:8. 13:8. Again, 13:8, 13:14. Oh, did I say 13:8 twice?
No.
Okay, 13:8. Devarim 12:26 and... Shmos 12:26 and Devarim 6:20. Okay? So, those are... Right, so you have to look up the psukim and do a little bit of homework. Like you could prepare your own class on this kind of thing if you actually looked up the psukim and compared it with the way the Haggadah presents it. Look at the context of those questions, see what's going on. And there's another component to it, which is that for the question of the chacham and the tam, that's the wise son and the simple son,
The Torah describes how that question is going to be asked machar. Okay? When you're going to have this question, this conversation tomorrow, as opposed to what's going to take place, you got to tell Avincha b'yom ahu, you're going to answer your child, you're going to tell your child on that day, or in response to the question, again, which is defined as a Russia, ma'ava da zos lachem, yamar teilav, you're just going to tell him. It's not going to take place tomorrow. So what's the difference between a response on that day or a response tomorrow? Okay, and that's it's an interesting question just in terms of how we view the need for this conversation. The Haggadah says that these children all have different things going on. Right, the Chacham, he's wise. What does that mean? Chacham, wise? He could be a wise guy. I don't know. Right? What does wise mean? Russia, is the Russia dumb? Is Russia a fool? No, the Russia seems to be quite intelligent, technically. What about the Tam? Is the Tam an idiot? Is that, what does a Tam mean? Yaakov is defined in the Torah as an Ish Tam. Is anybody going to say Yaakov Avinu is an idiot? Chalil v'chas. So Tam doesn't mean dumb or silly. It means that maybe he's just, a Pashat the Yid, a simple Jew, no crazy needs. And what about the Ein Yodei Lishol? Doesn't know how to ask. What does that mean? So in every Haggadah, they paint like a kid who looks like this. That's not very nice. Ein Yodei Lishol means not very good at asking questions. Maybe he's an introvert. What does that mean? Is an introvert a fool?
No.
Not necessarily. And in many cases, actually the opposite. Introvert is very smart, but the introvert doesn't like having conversations. Okay? It doesn't mean the introvert isn't intelligent. So what is an Ein Yodei Lishol? So we're not dealing with levels of intelligence. Okay? We're dealing with personality types. And I think that's a better way to understand what the sons are. So why machar? Why does the Torah say you're going to have this conversation tomorrow? And I think that one of the points that needs to be brought out is that this is a continuing dialogue. Okay, it's not just about I'm going to give you an answer here and now. We're part of it, what it means to educate a child or to talk about Judaism is to say, all right, you're asking a question, good question. I want to think about how I'm going to respond to you. Now, here we're at the Seder, we don't have that time. Well, that's why we have the Haggadah text. But we have to not just look at the verses in the vacuum of how the Haggadah gives it to us. We have to look at the verses in the vacuum, a much larger vacuum, of how the Torah gives it to us, and also bear in mind, and this is something which applies in many areas of learning and study, that when we come across a verse that's quoted somewhere, we have to imagine that we are big Talmidei Chachamim, big scholars, and that we know what the context of the verse is. When we read psukim like this, so anybody who knows the words of the Torah well reads these psukim and automatically has recall about what the context of this is all about. So if we don't have that, so that's a flaw in us. It means we haven't studied enough. And we can all take that criticism. And if you ever meet some Christians, for example, they can quote chapter and verse. Now, maybe it's the same chapter and verse that they're told to quote. But they read Scripture. We don't read Scripture. We don't. We hear it on Shabbos. Okay? And that's it. And we don't necessarily commit it to memory in any way. Now, we're not required to commit it to memory. But if somebody says to us, oh, there's a mitzvah, right? There's a mitzvah of, love your neighbor. We should know where it is. We should know where to be able to find it. And that's a challenge to all of us. If we can't answer those kinds of questions, where is the mitzvah to send away the mother bird? Okay, we should know. So love your neighbor, that's in Parshas Kedoshim. Okay, we're going to be reading it in a few weeks in the book of Vayikra. Sending away the mother bird, it's in Parshas Kisetse. Okay, these are just some things which you know. Avram Avinu, okay, the story of we're about to get to it in the Haggadah. Avram has the covenant between the pieces, the Brisbane and Avasarim. Where is that in the Torah? Now, I would imagine that everybody knows that Avram is in the book of Bereishis. So I'll give you that. Good. Okay, we know that Avram is in the book of Bereishis. What chapter? Okay, right? There were one or two years I taught high school, and I taught Bereishis in high school. And that was what my exams were. My exams were, here's the story. What chapter is it? Now, I don't need you to give me the verse. I need you to know the chapter. Okay, this way at least you can look it up. Okay, there are two covenants that Avram has. One's in chapter 15, one's in chapter 17. Covenant between the pieces is first. Covenant of circumcision, second.
And so that's why, that's how you know which one's which. 15 and 17. Tesvav and Yudzai. Okay, so.
Just getting back to the 4 cents.
Mm-hmm.
So one terminology that I'll be stopping here. I wonder what it's going to tell us. Because when you think Russian has a certain connotation, and especially with teenagers who really question it today, if you look at the relevance of it, nobody wants to be determined a Russia just because you say, well, what meaning? Tell me the meaning. So,
correct. And I agree with you. I think that nowadays, and I actually just had this, I'm on a few rabbinic listservs, and somebody asked a question today or yesterday about what was the question that he asked? I think there's going to be a bar mitzvah sometime soon, and somebody in the family is married, there's a man who's married to a non-Jewish woman, and he wants to know if he can give the person an aliyah, okay, at the bar mitzvah. Okay, as the person who's married a non-Jewish woman, taking himself out of the community, okay? So somebody else responded and said, "Well, what does the person say when is the person married to the non-Jewish woman because he's like, I'm going to stick it to the Jewish community, I'm going to show them, or needed companionship, found companionship in this person, and it is what it is. But the person hasn't denied God, and the person doesn't disrespect the Torah, so the person is just living in sin. Okay, the person's living in sin." So, and somebody else made the observation, and I've heard it said about people, for example, who grew up in America. Like, once upon a time, you used to have in the European shtetl, when there was no such thing as a car, so there was a guy who was like a real apikiris, and what would he do? He would go in front of the shul on Shabbos to smoke, just to stick it to people. Okay? So nowadays, you have, for example, people who drive to shul on Shabbos. Okay, are they driving to shul on Shabbos because they're sticking it to people? Or are they driving to shul because they want to get to shul and they live in America, and how are they going to get to shul? So there are rabbis today, very respectable rabbis, who say there's nobody in that first category anymore. Nobody's in that first category. They're going, I'm going to stick. These people are coming to shul. They want to daven. They want to hear the Torah reading. They want to learn something. So how do we evolve? I mean, the Haggadah hasn't evolved. Of course, the Haggadah is a text. So that's something which a lot of people struggle with. Okay, there's a Russia. So is that the case? So maybe there is a type. Fewer and farther between than once upon a time. Okay, now the fact that it's being ascribed to a child is very difficult. Okay, it's very hard for us to relate to that. And I agree with you. I don't have a good answer. Afata hakei shina, what does that mean? You're going to knock out his teeth? You're going to blunt his teeth? What are we talking about? I don't know. There's only one person. I'm just trying to think. I mean, correct me if I'm wrong. There's one person in the Torah that I can think about who, when we sometimes refer to him, we refer to him as his name, Harusha. Anybody? Chaim? Oh, Chaim. No. Chaim Harusha. No, I'm just kidding. Esav Harusha. Right? Esav. So maybe there's that little connection. I don't know. I mean, it's just funny because I mentioned before that Yaakov is a Tam and Esav is Harusha. And there's one very well-known midrash about Esav, which is that Esav, when he met Yaakov, he tried to bite him, and something happened to his teeth. And wouldn't you know that it happens to mention something related to the Russia's teeth? Okay, just food for thought. I just made that up right now. Sounds clear. Pretty good. Okay. Okay, so that's what I wanted to say about the sons. Again, the point was that machar, the concept of machar means that some conversations you can have an immediate answer, and some conversations are, we're going to continue this tomorrow. And not just tomorrow, but we're going to continue it because it's that important, and it's not something that I just want to leave here and now and not continue. Okay, now the next paragraph after the four sons is Yachol Meirosh Kodesh. Okay, so I'm going to skip that one. I'll go to the next one, which is Mitchilo De'Avarazara. Okay, Mitchilo De'Avarazara. So I mentioned this before, and now we're finally getting to it. Which means that originally our ancestors were idolaters, and now God has brought us close to Him. There's that word hamakom again, by the way, which is referring to God. And it quotes a few verses from Yehoshua. I mentioned these last week in pointing out that the end of the quote from the book of Yehoshua, the very next pasuk in the book of Yehoshua, mentions Moshe. So it's clearly deliberate that the Haggadah stops telling us at the very end. So just look at the end of that paragraph. What's described here is how I took your father Avram from the other side of the river, and I took him throughout the land of Canaan. I gave him children. I gave him Yitzchak. I mentioned that all these people are going to appear in the Haggadah. Avram, Yitzchak, Yaakov. Okay, and I gave Yitzchak, Yaakov, and Esav. I gave Esav Har Seir, Mount Seir, to inherit, and Yaakov and his sons went down to Egypt. Now, if this is the story of the Jewish people, why is Esav being mentioned? Okay, now it's in the context of a pasuk regarding that's quoted from the book of Yoshua. Yoshua is telling the Bnei Yisrael in the time of right before he's about to die, they've come in, they've conquered the land, they've inherited the land, and he's telling them, how did we get to here? We got to here because Avram, Yitzchak, Yaakov. Yaakov had a brother named Esav, and now us. Yaakov and his family went down to Egypt. Okay, so why is Esav being mentioned? So I want to tell you, there's a fascinating midrash about Esav. Okay, you remember the story when Yaakov and Esav are going to meet? So Yaakov is coming back after having lived with Lavan. And Parshas Vayishlach, Yaakov sends messages to Esav, telling him, here's some animals, and I've been living with Laban. And he finds out that Esav's coming towards him with how many men? Anyone remember? How many? 400, correct. 400. Interesting number. How many other times in the Torah do we have the number 400? I mean, other than in the context of like 400 and something, okay? The answer is 2. Meaning only 400, not 400 and something. Okay, 400. The answer is 2. Abraham buys the cave of Machpelah for 400 silver pieces. And Abraham is told, your descendants are going to be strangers in a strange land for 400 years. Okay? So I'm going to leave aside Machpelah for now, okay, because that's it's a deeper conversation. I don't want to get into. But Abraham is told, your descendants are going to be strangers in a strange land for 400 years. There is a midrash that says that Esav, where was Esav coming from with his 400 men? He says, Esav, Yaakov was gone for a long time. Esav saying, how am I going to kill my brother if I can't get to him? He's off in the east. I'm going to get a job. So one of the things which he did was he became a tax collector in Egypt. Tax collector in Egypt. And while he's in Egypt, he sees that what's going on in Egypt is they're building a kind of infrastructure here which is ripe for the fulfillment of the promise that was given to Grandpa Abraham. And Esav said, I'm out of here. I don't want to be part of that. So what does he do? He takes with him 400 men. And when he meets Yaakov, he says, I have my 400, you can have Avram's 400. Okay, that's the connection that the Midrash makes. Okay, I got my 400, you can have your 400. And Esav goes off, and Esav invites Yaakov to join him. He says, if you want out also, you can join me in the land of Seir, where I'm going. And Yaakov says, no, thank you. I'm going back to Yitzchak, and I'm going to follow whatever that destiny is. So Esav is being mentioned here as a contrast to show us that there's this trajectory, and there's the Esav trajectory. And how do we know that that is the case? Because the very next thing which follows is Baruch Shomer Avtachasol Yisrael Baruch Hu, blessed is the one who kept his promise to Israel. Blessed is he. And what does that little paragraph talk about? It talks about Avraham Avinu, the promise which was made to Avraham in the Brisbane of Sarim, the covenant between the pieces. And what was told to Avraham there? Yadoa teidak geri azarachab eretz lalehem v'avadum v'inu osam arba me'oshana. Right there you have the number 400, that Avraham was given this promise. V'gamas agoya she'avodu danu nochi v'achrechen yitzu b'ruchush gadol. Okay, and that after that time, the nation that will enslave them will be judged, and then they're going to leave with great wealth. So the significance of Avraham is not something to be ignored, not just because the whole Egypt story relates to that, but it's because of what Avraham did at that time. There is a verse in the Torah which I think is probably one of the most significant verses in the Torah for the story of the Jewish people throughout history, and is ignored. 7 words, okay? Abraham, remember, in that covenant, what does Abraham do? Avram cuts a bunch of animals in half, except for the birds, and he separates them on two sides, so there's like an aisle between, and there's some vision which takes place, and God somehow goes between the animals. And the Torah says the following. It says, Vayered ha'ayit al ha'pegarim, vayashev osam Avram. Which means that vultures, or some kind of bird of prey, came down on these pieces of the animals, and Avram sent them away. Okay, now it totally makes sense. Of course, you have dead animals. These birds of prey are going to come, and they're going to want to eat the meat. So what does Avram have to do? He has to chase them away, because he can't have this experience of these birds of prey are attacking these dead animals. I don't mean attacking. I mean, they want to eat from these dead animals. That pasuk of Avram chasing away those who are trying to get in the way of his covenant is a metaphor for the entire story of the Jewish people. Okay, just think about it. So when we have this image of Avram being promised 400 years, we have to understand what Avram is doing at that time. He is already setting the stage for the getting rid of those who are trying to consume or defeat that which Avram is doing in the service of God. Avram cuts these animals. That's representative of his connection and his faith in God. And the ayit, those birds of prey, are trying to destroy that. So that's another image, which again has to be recalled when we read this pasuk. We're reading a verse that tells us about Avram being told 400 years, and there's going to be suffering, and there's going to be whatever it may be, but then they're going to leave with great wealth. Now, here's a fascinating question, and this plays right into what comes after this. The next thing which we do is we raise up our cup, we say, that what stood for our fathers and us is that it wasn't just one that tried to stand up and destroy us. Rather, it's in every generation that people come up to destroy us. And God saves us. God saves us. So, what does that mean? It means, what's the he sha'am de lavo sainu? What's the he? Okay, it's that covenant. It's that promise that was made to Avram. What was the promise that was made to Avram? Your children are going to be strangers in a strange land for 400 years, and afterwards, I'm going to take them out. And I'm going to redeem them. I'm going to bring them back. So now here's the question. I just told you a midrash that says that Esav looked at Egypt and said, infrastructure, slavery, this is the place. Okay, did it have to be Egypt? What was the promise that was made to Avram? Your children are going to be strangers in a strange land for 400 years. Va'avadum, and they will be enslaved. Ve'inu osam, and they will make them suffer. Now, those are words. What do they mean? Do they mean that the degree of slavery and suffering has been preordained? No. Okay, and that's actually one of the things which is raised in the question of why did Egypt need to be punished so much? What did the Egyptians do? And the answer might be that every man Egyptian maybe didn't even do all that much. It's the taskmasters. It's Pharaoh's orders that did it. Now, I'm not defending Egypt. Please don't get the wrong impression. But the point is that Egypt took it to a much higher degree than they needed to in order to achieve Avadun v'inuosam. Pharaoh didn't have to kill babies. Pharaoh didn't have to, and there are a host of midrashic interpretations of the plagues that were tit for tat for the kinds of suffering that Egypt placed upon the Jewish people, the Bnei Israel. They went much, much higher, much farther. But guess what? I found an amazing interpretation that said that the promise that was given to Abraham was 400 years. When did the 400 years begin? Is it 400 years of slavery?
No.
How long are they in Egypt? 210 years. Okay, right. From the time that Yaakov gets down until the time that they leave is 210 years. Okay? If you do the math, 400 years actually begins when Yitzchak is born. Okay, and I know that a lot of you know that. So, there in Egypt, when they come down to Egypt, the beginning of 210 years, Yosef has been a king already for 9 years. The Torah tells us Yosef lives from the time that they get down, he lives until he's 39. From the time that they get down, Yosef dies at the age of 110. That's what the Torah says. So, assuming that those numbers are not exaggerated or anything like that, from the time that they come down to Egypt until Yosef dies is 71 years. Okay? From 39 to 110, 71 years. During that time, were they slaves?
No.
Of course not. Yosef's a king. They're not going to be slaves. We have a tradition that until the oldest of them died, and our tradition is that Levi is the oldest of them who died, and Levi his age is mentioned in the Torah. He's 137 when he died. But there was no slavery until after Levi died. Okay, Levi and Yosef were maximum 4 years apart. So add another, so that means that when Yosef died, Levi was 114. Add another 23 years. So now we had already 71 years plus another 23 years. And even if slavery started immediately at that point in time, what do we have? We have, that's, how many years is that? 71 plus 23 is 94. So subtract from 210, 94, and there's a maximum of 116 years of slavery. Maximum. Okay, I'm not belittling it, but that's maximum. That's a lot less than 400. Okay, that's a lot less than 400. So what happens? Abram was told 400 years, your children will be strangers in a strange land. So where was Yitzchak born? Canaan. Was that land owned by Abraham? No. Were they strangers in a strange land? Yes. Where does Yaakov go when he leaves the family? Where does he go? No. Yaakov goes to Lavan. Okay, how long is he there? 20 years. Strangers in a strange land. It could have been there. It could have been there that they had stayed. But what was the problem? In every generation, they're trying to destroy. What's the next line in the Haggadah? And we're probably going to conclude with this. Say ulamad. Say ulamad. Okay, this is where we get into the great detail about all the stuff that we want to say about you know how, what it means to be denigrated. Maschil begnus and Messiah Meshavach. Say ulamad. Go out and look. Ma bikesh Lavan arami lasos liyakov avinu. What did Lavan want to do? Paro decreed to kill the males. Lavan wanted to destroy everything. Yes?
Can I go back to just Bikishamda one second?
Sure.
So another thing that I was just thinking about Bikishamda, we're talking the same, it's the breed, right? And the breed is not just between Avram and Hashem, it really is between all of Am Yisrael, every generation, and Hashem. So it means when it says Bikishamda Lavatina Lavanu, even to this day, this breed, which still Hashem is also a dying mitchayev. So we still have this dual relationship and responsibility and accountability to the brit. And that's why we know that even to all of our children, we're able to answer, yes, this is our responsibility, we have to do this, because we are still accountable to the brit.
Yes. Yes. I would of course agree, and I think that's a key thing that is not just a theme of the Seder. That's a theme of every single day of the year.
Right.
Okay, we are part of the story of the Jewish people. And what does that mean? And again, that's a much deeper conversation that should be had all the time. And I'm sure that conversation is had in Israel today. I know it's had today because outside of Israel, the most people who identify as Israelis who live in any place in the world is in Florida. So whatever. And it's a big conversation. It's a big conversation. Why? And you know, every Jew should probably ask that question, several times a year, which is this what my life should be, or is that my life should be? And you know, without the Beis Hamikdash, it's a different conversation. You know, if the Beis Hamikdash were built, I would say we should all be out of here in an instant. But without it, and that's, you know, it should be the struggle that every Jew outside of the land of Israel has. But nevertheless, we have a covenant, and this is the story of our Jewish people. This is the story of the Jewish people, and we are continuation in a chain. So I want to finish with this thought. I had a lot more to say, but I just want to finish with this, and it'll take a couple minutes. Okay, the Torah tells us here that Ma bikesh Lavan arami lasos liyakov avinu. What did Lavan want to do? He wanted to destroy everything, whereas Paro only made a decree against the males. And what's the proof? The proof is Arami Obed Avi Vayered Mitzrayma Vayagar Shem Seimar Vayisham Lagoy Gadol Tzumurav. Okay, and what the Haggadah does here is it gives us a few verses from the declaration that a person makes when bringing the first fruits, the Bikurim. What parsha is it in, everybody? Okay, next time you're going to know. It's in Parshas Kitavo, towards the end of the book of Devarim. And you should know this. You should know the context of what's going on. And by the way, if you look and see what the Haggadah does this all the time. The Haggadah uses 4 out of the 6 verses that a person would make in the declaration when they would bring their first fruits in a basket. They bring it, they're ready to give it to the Kohen. 4 of the verses, which give the history of the Jewish people, how we got to this point,
And now I'm here, the part which the Haggadah doesn't say is, and now I'm here, and now I have my piece of property, and now I'm in the land, and now I'm so grateful for all the gifts that you've bestowed upon me, here are my first fruits. The part about coming to the land is not mentioned in the Haggadah, because that's not what the point of the Haggadah is. The point of the Haggadah is the night of Egypt. The point of the Haggadah is Exodus. The point of the Haggadah is, Ani v'lo malach, ani v'lo seraph, God is saying, it's me, not an angel, me, not a seraph, not me, not any other kind of entity, being, etc. It's all about God. And what the Haggadah does is it uses those verses which the person says in telling over the history of the Jewish people that brought them to the land of Israel, up until the point of bringing it to the land of Israel, and then it analyzes those verses, and that's what all of Tzei Olamot is. But what's Arami Oved Avi? Arami Oved Avi means that an Aramite, Arami, somebody from Aram, okay, somebody from Aram, where's Aram? That's in Mesopotamia. Which area of Mesopotamia? Good question. Okay? What?
Near the water.
Right, near a water. Right, thank you very much. Okay, we got a couple of rivers up there. So Avram started in Aram Naharaim, and then with his father Terach, they moved from there to Haran. Avram continues to Canaan, and Lavan is a descendant of Avraham's brother Nahor. What's Lavan's name? Lavan Ha'arami. Why is he called Lavan Ha'arami? Because he's from Aram. So where does Yaakov go when he goes? Does Yaakov go to Aram or does Yaakov go to Haran? So, you know, it seems like there's a cross of the two different places. I'm not going to get into it. He goes to Haran. That's the way the Torah describes it. But sometimes they talk about how Yaakov went to Aram. Okay, but if you look up this pasuk in Parshas Kisavo, Devarim 26, Devarim 26, look it up. Look at every commentary on it. And you're going to find that they have different interpretations as to who the Arami is. Some say that the Arami is Lavan. Some say the Arami is Yaakov. Some say the Arami is Abraham. Why? Because what does the word Oved mean? Oved could mean to destroy. Right? Haman bikesh laharog ula'abed. Right? Haman wanted to kill and destroy and wipe out. You ever hear, remember that song? Uva uha ovdim, right? What is ovdim there? It's spelled with an aleph. Aleph is dal. What does it mean?
The lost ones.
The wanderers. Okay? So oved, it's not clear what it means. Arami oved avi. That's why some of the commentaries say it's referring to Lavan, because an Arami wanted to destroy my father. But another one is that an Arami was my wandering father. Hey, where did Avram come from originally? Where did Avram come from? Aram! Aram! That's where he came from. That's where he was born. So the Arami could be my wandering father. Avram is wandering. Avram goes from Aram to Haran to Canaan to Mitzrayim, back to Canaan. I mean, he's all over the place. And in Canaan, Beersheba, and Kiryat Arba. And you know, I mean, he's Hebron. He's everywhere. He's a wandering Jew. So what are we talking about here? Arami Oved Avi, Vayered Mitzrayim. So eventually, now, what does that mean? Vayered Mitzrayim. Arami Oved Avi, and if it's referring to Yaakov, is also a wandering Jew. Yaakov is in Canaan, and then he has to go to Haran, and then he goes back to Canaan, and then he goes down to Egypt. He's a wandering Jew. Where could Yaakov have been enslaved? Where could it have been? It could have been in Lavan's house. Think about it. Yaakov goes to Lavan, and what does he say when he leaves? He says to Lavan, you have enslaved me, you have mistreated me, you changed my wages how many times. You wanted to destroy everything. The reason I have to leave, and the reason why I stole away, you know, quote unquote, in the middle of the night, is because you want to destroy my family. And Lavan even says it. Lavan even says to him, he says, Yesh la'el yadila asosim mechemra, when they have the encounter at the end of Parshas Vayetze, Lavan says to Yaakov, I could have destroyed you, but you know why I don't? Because last night I had a dream, and your God appeared to me, and he said to me, Shamar lecha, right, be careful lest you harm Yaakov, because if you harm Yaakov, I'll destroy you. Well, I don't want to be destroyed, so I'm not, and that's why they agreed to make a treaty, and Yaakov was able to go on his way, and they make a wall, which is called Gal'ed, and they part ways. But Yaakov could have stayed there. That could have been the 400 years could have been there. Okay, where did Lavan go wrong? He totally misplayed his hand at a time when Yaakov still was in a position of power. And so Yaakov left. But think about it. Why does the Haggadah tell us that Lavan bikesh lakor asakol? It doesn't make any sense.
Hey, Paro, what does Paro have for the Jewish people? What kind of feelings does he have for the Jewish people? Nothing. Maybe he liked Yosef, or maybe his father liked Yosef, or his grandfather liked Yosef. Maybe they had a nice relationship. Paro, but Yosef's long gone, and Paro's looking at the Jewish people, and he says, ding, money, cha-ching, right? This is my economy now. He doesn't need these people for who they are. He needs them because he could put a number on their arm. And he could say, this is slave number one, slave number two, slave number 3 million. That's what he can do. Lavan looks at Yaakov's children, and what does he say? Do I need them? They're my grandchildren. I love every single one of them. They're my kids. And that's what he even says to Yaakov. He says, Habanos benasai, Habanim benai. Your daughter, the ladies are mine. The sons are mine. They're all mine. They're my children. And Yaakov says, get lost. Your daughters you gave me. We made a fair deal. And the children, I mean, yeah, but like a parent has a right to raise his children. So you can buy them gifts. You can be the grandfather. You can take them to Disney. But after Disney, guess what? I get them back. Okay, but Lavan said, no, they're mine. Because Lavan wanted to take the mind and the heart in a way that Yaakov never would have allowed. And so the Haggadah makes that note and says, Lavan is more dangerous than Paro, because Paro just cared about the body. He didn't care about the heart and the mind. There's a very well-known midrash about how the Jewish people merited to leave Egypt. The answer is they didn't change a few things. They didn't change their names, language, clothing. One of them is that they didn't say any lashon hara about each other. That's the difference between the influence that Lavan had and the influence that Paro had. Paro said, you guys can live in Goshen, do your thing, I don't care. You'll remain B'nai Yisrael. You'll be the slaves, and we'll harm you, we'll beat you, we'll do everything to you, but we're not going to destroy your identity. The B'nai Yisrael in Egypt, they were idolaters. Everybody knows this. Everybody agrees. But they were idolaters who, with the right influencer, could turn it around. They could, within 7 weeks, get from Egypt to Sinai and say Nasa v'nishma. And that's the difference between Lavan and Paro. If they had stayed in Lavan's house, there never would have been a Sinai. God would have had to find a different nation. But the fact that they went down to Egypt, that is Yehisha Amda. That's what stood for the B'nai Israel. Because Yaakov saw that I can't push away this ayat, this bird of prey. There's no way. He's too heavily invested in these children. He wants them. But if we can go someplace else and eventually be slaves in an Egypt, for example, then we can maintain our identity. And I think that that's V'hisha Amdala Vosenu, that we need to realize and recognize. And that's the story of the Haggadah. And that's the story to the Russia, right? To the child who's getting there. He says, you have no idea. You know, you could have all your umbrage and all your braggers, and you could be upset and everything. You don't even want to be here. But you have no idea what we've been through to get to this table. You have no idea what we've been through to be here. We could all sit around this table and have a conversation. Because you want to be under the influence of Lavan. But if you do that, guess what? As we all know, I think it was Milton Himmelfarb who said, what do you call the great-grandchildren of intermarried Jews? Christians. Okay? It's not a very unfamiliar story. It's very clear. I think I've told in shul many times, if I ever get a great-grandparent calling me to do a bris, I know that the child is not Jewish. His mother for sure is not Jewish, possibly even his grandmother. Okay? And so there you go. That's the story of the Jewish people. So that's who we are, and that's what the Haggadah is about. The Haggadah is about connection to generation and realizing that even when the Arami Oved Avi, Vayered Mitzrayma, even if we live in an amazing country, but we're still in Egypt. And that's why we say, behold over door, we have to find a way to see ourselves as if we are leaving Egypt. And that was what Rabbi Soloveitchik was saying. It's about Talmud Torah. It's about recognizing what we're doing. One of the points, this is the final point that I'm going to make. Rabbi Soloveitchik says this as well, that why does the Magid end with a little bit of Hallel? A little bit of Hallel. Okay, the last two paragraphs right before that bracha is Hallel. He says, because that's the fulfillment of Bechol Dover Dor, that in every generation we have to feel as if we were enslaved and we got out. What did the Jewish people do when they left Egypt? Within a week, what were they doing? They're singing Shira, Azir Shira, when their Egypt is finally gone. And that's what it means to see that we are free. When we could sing Shira, when we could sing a song in praise of the Almighty, that's how we are fulfilling Bechol Dor Vador. And so therefore our job at the Seder is to, just to quote Rabbi Soloveitchik, to reenact to restage, to relive, and therefore re-experience what it means to leave Egypt. And it's the conversations that we have that are a first step. But like we say to the Ben HaChacham and the Ben HaTam, to the child who is wise and simple, it's not just about today, it's also about Machar, tomorrow, and here on after, to always have the conversation reminding us of what it means to be free Bnei Yisrael who have chosen to live under the wings of the Divine.